I tend to come down as a consequentialist, which means that if it can be shown and it is proven, best as you can prove these sorts of things, that it will have a net saving of human life, then I believe it is worth deploying. But how do you do this? That's the safety question. This is the safety practices that we were evaluating, as I mentioned before. Are these effective and adequate? I think the goal of most self-driving car programs is just that.
Welcome to the Regulating AI podcast. Join host Sanjay Puri as he explores the dynamic and developing world of artificial intelligence governance. Each episode features deep dives with global leaders at the forefront of regulating AI responsibly, tackling the challenges using AI can bring about head-on and enabling balance without hindering innovation.
Welcome to the Regulating AI podcast. Artificial intelligence, AI, stands at the forefront of technological evolution, with experts predicting that it could add trillions of dollars to our GDP, but it could also negatively impact our workforce and national security. So how do we regulate it without stifling innovation? Our podcast features insights from different perspectives. We have had industry leaders, government officials, to advocacy group leaders. Together, they address pivotal questions that are needed to create practical legislation. I'm very excited to have Professor Ronald Arkin with us today. Professor Arkin is a professor emeritus at the Georgia Institute of Technology. I invited him on this show as it's very important to get different perspectives towards framing AI legislation. And we wanted to get a perspective from a robotics and a robo-ethics expert. Welcome, Professor Arkin. It's an absolute pleasure to have you on the Regulating AI podcast.
Thank you, Sanjay. It's a pleasure to be here. And thank you so much for inviting me and letting my voice be heard in this forum.
It's a very important voice, Professor. So let's dive into some of the things that really need to be addressed. So, Professor, how can regulatory frameworks incorporate ethical guidelines that can govern the design and deployment of the use of robotic and unmanned systems? Because we see more and more use, whether it's in the military, in the civilian area. So tell us, how can regulatory frameworks incorporate these guidelines?
Well, there is some guidance to be had, of course, from past regulations that have gone on regarding productization of different things as well, too. Many agencies are available for self-driving cars, for example. The National Highway Transportation and Safety Authority is involved. In the military, there are bodies that do that. DARPA, for example, is starting to spin up a new program called DARPA ASIMOV, which is intended to incorporate ethics with military values into autonomous systems. And there are also other, apart from leveraging existing regulatory bodies, there are other organizations. I don't know if you've encountered folks from the IEEE Standards Association and their Global Initiative on Intelligent and Autonomous Systems, which has been one of the more successful, I would venture. I have had some part in that, efforts to try and bring together multidisciplinary perspectives, international perspectives, to try and create soft law or guidelines as a basis for moving forward and informing people as to the correct and incorrect way to consider the development of artificial intelligence and robotics.
So you just talked about the international aspect. Just to follow up on your point, are there international collaborations happening towards some of these standards and regulations, or how can regulations facilitate such collaboration, Professor?
Again, that's obviously hard, especially as ethics in general has a cultural dependency and different people have different perspectives. And there's a whole lot in Japan and Korea, like there's a whole lot, this is for the human robot side of things, a whole lot more tolerance for understanding how these agents, these intelligent agents, can become a part of someone's life. There's more worry in the West, which dates back to the Frankenstein syndrome and the like as well, where people are fearful of what may happen. That changes the perspective. But there are efforts. One of the big efforts, of course, which you probably encountered in your talks in the past, is the United Nations Convention on Certain Weapon Systems as well, too, the CCW, trying to figure out ways internationally to regulate these systems as they move forward, which are potentially very dangerous if not used appropriately, whatever that may mean. There are bodies. The World Economic Forum has been having consistently meetings over the last many years, I don't know exactly how many, to discuss how to create methods to harness AI without, as you said, stifling innovation. It's a really challenging problem because you want to move forward, but you don't want to move forward too fast. There are principles such as the precautionary principle from ethics, which talks about making sure that you have an understanding before you release the product into the wild, so to speak, of the potential harm and not release it before it is ready. There are many different bodies. Many are local as well, too. The EU has been developing guidelines. I think there are 80 different versions or more of what is the right way to do it, going all the way back to Isaac Asimov and his three, or actually four, laws of robotics. So how that gets created is not a problem, because 20 years ago, when I first got into this, there was very few voices. Almost just a few of us were talking about the potential impact of this technology as it moves forward. But now there's almost a cacophony of voices because everyone is worried about it. Everyone is differentially creating their different guidelines and principles to move forward. And that doesn't necessarily lead to a consensus approach. But it's better that people are talking about it than not.
That's very helpful, Professor. That kind of leads me to a two-part question. One is, especially a little over a year, there's just been this frenzy over large language models, ChatGPT, Bard, et cetera, and people have kind of forgotten a little bit about robotics and its use of AI. And now the EU AI Act, and there are over 100 bills in Congress talking about deepfakes and others. So should we not consider robots in there? That's a big consideration that we are trying to see. And also, a lot of people are talking that robotics are going to have a ChatGPT moment very soon. So I wanted to kind of just get some quick feedback from you on those two points.
Sure. You have to keep in mind that robotics is basically the embodiment, a physical embodiment of artificial intelligence. There's a lot of stuff that's going back to the broader definition of robotics that is hard automation, which have any intelligence at all to speak of, and is very helpful, but still creates ethical questions regarding unemployment as it puts people out of dangerous, dirty, and dull kinds of tasks. Robotics manifests artificial intelligence in a physical way in the real world. So ChatGPT, the ability of human-robot interaction, that will obviously, I am really impressed at how far Alexa, for example, who I rely on daily to tell me what the tides are, where I am, or the weather, or how my sports teams are doing, and really has a good grasp, not great grasp, a good grasp of natural language, and can also generate that work. And large language models now with a generative approach, you're right, that's going to affect robotics, as well as the perception side of things and learning. LLMs are basically with anywhere there's large, massive amounts of data, you can affect the performance of these systems in ways that are quite surprising. And so there has been a major paradigm shift, and that's working its way in. We just had a paper that we put in I can't remember which conference it was in, but it was talking about LLMs and from an ethics perspective. And we basically asked them ethical questions and tried to see if there was a consensus, because that there is no understanding in LLMs of what's going on. There is zero. They don't know anything, but people attribute intelligence to them and provide an easy to use interface. So it's a bit frightening how susceptible people are. And having worked with companies like Sony and Samsung on physical robots like Aibo, which was the robot dog that they have generally, it's easy to see how once you understand and study human psychology, how it can be exploited, how you can tap into that and create artifacts that have an effective relationship with people. All these things are crucially important, and LLMs will only exacerbate that as they create the appearance of intelligence more and more for these systems.
So you obviously talked about the measure of ignorance. So if that is the case, then what mechanism should be established within regulations to make sure that there is oversight and compliance with ethical standards in the development of some of these systems, Professor?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I'm kind of a proponent of Lawrence Lessig's forces. A professor at Harvard talks about four different ways. I use this in my classes as well, too, that you can control the way in which people interact with things in the world. There's legislative, which you folks are focused on as well, too, the creating of laws, hard regulations. There's economic. I mean, you can price things out so that people can't afford it, or tax them or tariff them to some extreme level where they become regulated through that. There's social stigma. Smoking, for example, is a classic example of there. Yeah, there's legislation, but if people light up a cigarette, even outside right now, pressure on them to stop using that. And of course, technological changes and advents as well, too, ways in which technology can be put to use to do that. So there's many different mechanisms apart from legislation which can guide things. But the real question is not just creating legislation, but legislation that has force. So how do you enforce these things? And I know you folks are interested in the ways in which that's done. What are the appropriate penalties for this, if there are? And the issues of social justice as well, too, Rawlsian ethics, if you will. How do you ensure that the technology is available to all those who have a potential need for it as well, too? This is very common in healthcare and robotics technology for healthcare. The EU is very concerned with ensuring that. So there's many different aspects associated with managing this. And also, probably the deepest question is, whose ethics are you putting into the system, right? I mean, someone has to make fundamental decisions regarding what is right and wrong, and that gets codified into legislation at some point in time. And eventually, you may outgrow that, or it may become immoral, or it may have been immoral from the beginning as well, too, as deemed later in history or by other subgroups. How do you manage that? Challenging, not just for AI, but for legislation in general, whether it be abortion or smoking or gun control, all these different things. How do you decide what's right and wrong? And how are you going to do that for artificial intelligence? The best way, I would say, is to have solid discussion and solid debate from many different points of view and see if you can converge on some fundamental principles that we can agree upon.
Now, those are great points, Professor. Do you think we can have mandatory testing and certification processes, or we can have regulations around that verify the ethical compliance of these robotic and unmanned systems before they're deployed in various applications?
Mandatory is a strong word. Okay. As well. And I would say it depends on the domain in which you're talking about. In the military, there are very strict requirements before, even in the early stages of development of new weapons technology, for example, Article 14, I think it's called, but I'm not sure, where you have to show that the technology that you have or are or proposing to create is consistent with international humanitarian law, which are the Geneva Conventions, the Hague Conventions, and the like. So those are pretty tightly regulated, and major defense contractors are heavily required, at least in our country, can't say for all countries, but in our countries, to adhere to the underlying principles. Now, I was involved in some recent consulting work to evaluate the safety requirements for autonomous vehicles, cars, those that are driving around on roads today as taxis and the like. And yeah, exactly. That is basically currently self-policing. That's not to say that the companies that are doing it aren't developing and using good practices to understand the safety associated and the risks associated with that and moving cautiously forward. But it's a little worrisome potentially because, especially in high tech, there is a constant pressure to move technology out the door because it's not just how good it is, to be candid, it's how fast it gets to the marketplace. And that is what often captures market share. So there is potential tension and compromise that may occur to, I'll say, ethical considerations, maybe or maybe not safety considerations, but hopefully not, as not only self-driving cars, but almost any form of technology. Look at what happened with Facebook and other things as well, too. All these things with social media and the like, there's risk associated with it. So how can you put the brakes on it to say, don't move forward without a company losing its competitive edge? Very hard and challenging to do. It's the, as you mentioned at the beginning, it's the stifling innovation and risking, as other nations, which may have less regulations imposed upon them in these other domains, how they can move forward and faster and capture the market and leave the other countries behind. It's really challenging.
Professor, let's talk about robot emotions, which you have worked on quite a bit. So with the advancement in robotics that are obviously enabling the development of emotionally expressive robots, what kind of considerations should be there in the regulatory frameworks to make sure that there is a responsible design and ethical use in the emotional capabilities of robots?
First, I need to mention that robots do not possess emotions. They do not possess them, but they can be made to appear to possess emotions. And I've, as I mentioned, I've worked with companies and have multiple patents on, quote, I like to use scarecrows, robot emotions for that. The dangers associated with that is it's inherently deceptive, right? I mean, making you think, or the robot is making you think that it's happy or it's sad. And any AI can do that. It's LLM can do that. Alexa can do that. You can ask it all kinds of questions. It'll try and convey some internal state of emotions that it may have. This aspect of deception, AI deception and robot deception, I've been working on for the last, 10, 15 years in a variety of different domains, and always incorporate considerations for the ethical aspect of that and the discussions associated with that in my publications and work and talks, which I've given around the world on that. But the question, is it appropriate to allow someone, even if it makes them feel better, it makes them feel good because this robot can make you feel like it's a real companion. Is that ethically appropriate? Well, it boils down to some degree on which school of ethics you adhere to. If you're a consequentialist, you base things on outcomes. If it makes people happy, isn't that a good thing, right? There are others that are what are called deontologists or right-based or Kantians who argue that there is a fundamental right for people to perceive the world as it is. And if you are deceiving them, it is inherently wrong. I've had large debates, both in print and in person, with other philosophers, and this has brought me deep into the philosophy community, that I tend to fall on the side of consequentialism in most of my work as well, too. Outcomes are better. If I can save civilian lives, for example, in warfare, to me, that is a crucial component. And the outcome of existing war with damage to civilians is utterly intolerable. But others argue that there is a fundamental right for people not to be killed by robots. And how do you balance these perspectives? How do you do these sorts of things? And the same thing relies for many domains. Same thing for unemployment. If we can do the jobs better and help certain stakeholders, isn't that a good thing? But then again, don't people have a fundamental right to have a dull, dirty, or dangerous job if it provides them with a family and an income that they would not have if a robot replaces this and takes away their happiness from that sense? What's right and what's wrong? And I tend to not be prescriptive in saying what's right and what's wrong. As an ethicist, we explore the different moral codes as opposed to prescribe and say, this is the right one and this is the wrong one. And so we try and find ways in which to imbue robots, if you will, with different ethical frameworks. And we're just finishing up some work that we've done for the National Science Foundation, studying that problem specifically from both expert ethicists and what we call folk morality, what people actually think is right and wrong, which is not based on ethical, formal ethical frameworks.
So just to make sure I understand, are you for having a regulatory framework that would ensure ethical use of the emotional capabilities of robots, or you think that's not possible?
I think it's possible. Indeed, in the IEEE, I headed up the affective group under the IEEE Global Initiative on Autonomous Systems, and we came up with a couple of guidelines associated with that. One is whether you should opt in, opt out, or no way out for the use of this technology. It's like informed consent. You should be made aware, and that does not necessarily mean you get all that boilerplate every time you download a new app or something like that says, do you agree to this? And it's 50 pages long. And sure, I agree, but I'm not sure exactly what I agreed to in the particular case. So you have to make a decision like that. That was one of the things that we talked about. And the other one is we talked about potential certification when deception is used and under in what circumstances it could be right. We said it's good for, potentially good for the, a guideline said, when it benefits the other person, it's called other deception. When it leads to their betterment and their advantage, which a deception can help with in a variety of different circumstances, but it can also be used maliciously. And so having that and having a regulatory body to be able to certify the technology before it goes to market would be very helpful. How to do that and how to implement that is outside of my pay grade, I guess, all too, but I can be a voice in helping that.
Just to follow on that question towards human-robot interaction, what regulatory frameworks or legislative measures do you believe are necessary to safeguard just the privacy user rights in terms of deployment of robots?
The privacy, of course, is a crucial issue, but it's no different in many respects, other than the fact that if you have a robot companion, it is with you potentially all the time. And imagine you had a robot dog and it did the same thing, or a cat, or it was your pet. It was actually with you all the time. Sees everything. It hears everything. You don't have to worry about someone getting a core dump of your data from your Cocker Spaniel or your Siamese at this point in time, but someone could potentially tap into these systems, or a government could mandate getting access to that information. Is that appropriate, and under what different types of circumstances? There is a trend as well, too, to something that people don't spend much time talking about because it's kind of a yuck factor discussion. It's a notion of robot intimacy and the fact that we are going to have ultimately, should we not destroy ourselves in the interim, real companions, which could be partners in every level of human-robot interaction. And what are we going to allow that? Are we going to legislate against that? Are we going to control it? I'm worried about it because it can potentially seriously affect the social fabric and the way in which we relate with each other. If you had, for example, a robot lover that is better than any lover that you've ever had or ever will have, what's that going to do? So how do we manage this technology? And people, unfortunately, as it's being created, and it is being created, often turn a blind eye to it because they don't want to talk about it. And that's one area I think that's second on my list of priorities behind lethal autonomous weapons is the robot intimacy aspects and the harm. And there is real harm that could potentially...
societal harm.
And individual harm as well, too.
Yeah. I mean, but the other argument is that we have a crisis of loneliness also in this country. But
definitely.
So let's just say, Professor, some of these companies who are producing these robots, and it's going to just with technology, the processing power, it's going to get more and more widespread, just like LLMs. If there are some ethical lapses by some of these robots, what kind of liability frameworks within regulations can hold these people responsible?
Again, I would probably say product safety regulations. I mean, we see doors blowing out of airplanes right now as well, too. There's all kinds of stuff regarding industrial regulation of the technology. In the military, of course, there's laws that exist that have been agreed upon that are widespread. How that gets attributed in the chain of responsibility becomes a little more complicated in that. Is it the person who deployed the system? Is it the person that used the system? Is it the commanding officer that allowed it to occur? Is it the product company that built the system, but it was built to appropriate specs and certified? Was it the scientist who came up with the idea? How do you attribute responsibility? And unfortunately, and the same for autonomous cars and the like as well too, which is probably a closer issue right now. I believe that the answers to these questions will be found in the courtroom. I don't care what you legislate. I think it's the law is going to be educated somewhere as to what's acceptable all the way up the judicial chain at some point, should they have room in their agenda to be able to do it, given what's going on.
Professor, you said that DARPA has something like an ethics review board. Should there be regulations to mandate these kind of review boards for the specific applications of robotics and unmanned technologies?
There are many review boards, even within companies as well, too.
Okay. For robots and unmanned systems.
Yeah, for AI and robots and all those things as well, too. I mean, there's hard to separate AI robotics and the like. I'm not talking about hard automation type of robotic systems as well, too. And those are clearly governed by OSHA and other things as well, too, which are the organizations that deal with it. It's when the smarts start getting into the system and the ability for people to start thinking that they're smart that we run into trouble. But many companies have this to guide the development. I've worked with the American Association for the Advancement of Science, trying to develop courses and principles by which they can educate industry as to what is in a good way and an appropriate way, a development cycle that you could potentially use. There are, having a bunch of people though doesn't make a board successful. And the real issue, is it in lip service only, or does it have real meat? And I fear the former rather than the latter for much of this. And we've seen boards disbanded because they came up with the wrong answer for whatever reason. Well, I'm trying to think of the company that we just had. Who was the gentleman who was fired? His employees protested, and he just recently, OpenAI. Yeah, you saw what happened there. I don't know the gory details of that. I was concerned about how that technology was being released. I was not involved in any of the discussions directly with it, but I was surprised that it was moving forward with people given the ability to evidently create their own versions of ChatGPT, local versions. That worried me somewhat. And I don't know what the boardroom meetings were like that led to his initial demise. And then the uprising that caused the reversal of that and the disbanding of the board, it's an interesting situation. And boards can certainly communicate their concerns, but they do not necessarily get acted upon. And I'm not saying that was a correct or incorrect case in that instance. I don't know enough about it, but it was an interesting data point.
Just to kind of follow up on that point, you talk about, obviously, your concern is about some of these technologies. You're referring to agents and things of that nature. And there is a lot of talk of open sourcing robots too. Are you against open sourcing? I mean, the discussion on open sourcing is now raging very heavily for LLMs, but it could be the same thing with robots too.
Open sourcing, the same, if we're referring to the software, is a very wise strategy overall because it allows others to inspect the code and understand how it was developed. So the deeper question, especially for LLMs, is data. Often the data can't be open sourced as easily because some of it is proprietary. And also open sourcing because of intellectual property rights, companies want to preserve their software that they spent in many cases millions and millions of dollars sometimes developing. Open source is a really important aspect for the sharing of software and software development in general. Again, it creates a tension as well between stifling innovation and discouraging people to move forward. And also, it creates potential liability after the fact, but it creates also potential opportunity for others to see vulnerability in the software as well.
Professor, let's just shift for a minute to talk about workforce and employment. About maybe 2 weeks ago, the IMF came out with a report, and there have been various reports by McKinsey and others, but IMF report was pretty stark, and it was quite a bit focused, I would say, on LLMs, but they talked about AI, where there could be job losses in industrialized countries up to 60%, let's say in the US, or changes, etc. Now, obviously, heavy focus on them was the application of large language models or Gen AI. But you could argue that robotics, the wide press use of robotics could have a pretty severe implication in terms of jobs and, as you talked about, societal implications. What are your thoughts, and should regulators be thinking about that? There's a lot of conversation going about for Gen AI in terms of reskilling our population, the workforce. Biden executive order talks about that, but nobody's talked about the application of robotics and its impact on workforce, at least from a regulatory standpoint.
Looking to make the most out of AI advancements and innovation? Visit regulatingai.org to learn more about how best to optimize the use and integration of AI, and sign up for the Regulating AI newsletter to keep up to date with the latest in AI governance and regulation.
Well, actually, the discussion of robotics predates LLMs by a decade too.
Public memory is very short in this town.
Well, the fear of unemployment is very real. And I agree that unemployment changes are likely to be massive. I don't know if 60% is the right number. LLMs threaten white-collar jobs a whole lot more than blue-collar jobs that robotics. Again, you can see robotic guides and other things as well, too, apart from just in industrial applications, which have already displaced tremendous numbers of workers over the year. What's interesting also is, again, with the Screen Actors Guild and other things as well, too, we're concerned with avatars, if you will, creating and stealing their body image and their language model and the like as well, too. And who owns that? Who gets royalties from those sorts of things? It's extremely challenging. So to me, finding ways to reduce the harm that people will suffer as this technology moves forward is crucial. And that is from both an educational perspective as well as an economic perspective, I would contend.
Professor, last week I was at CES and there was robotics all over the place. I mean, they had robotics for senior care, taking care of elder, a robot taking care of elder care in just a massive number. And I can tell you the larger proportion of companies that were displaying it were actually out from outside the US in many cases. So obviously it is coming and it will have an impact on society. Again, from a societal standpoint, now there is going to be positives as we have an aging population. So maybe there is a benefit for that. And as you said, there has to be something done from a regulatory standpoint. But talking about, are there any human rights implications? I mean, should regulations mandate some human rights impact assessments for deployment of robotic and unmanned systems?
Oh, absolutely. Again, as I mentioned, the notion of deception and creative robots that make people feel better, but they understand that they do not have life or they do not have agency, or they think that. Isn't there a fundamental human right to perceive the world as it is? You talked about the UN. Look at the UN Declaration of Human Rights as well, too, as a good starting point, which talks about the right to privacy. It talks about the right to food and education and all these other things as well, too. How can the technology be used in ways to accomplish that? Is it all about making people rich or is it enriching people's lives? And I would prefer it to be the latter, however defined. And I think that's where we need to pay significant attention to. And the UN Charter on the Declaration of Human Rights, I think, is a good place to begin. I've been in a bunch of meetings where that does serve as the basis for a starting point for these discussions.
Professor, to what extent should public consultation be involved and integrated into creating ethical regulations for robotic and unmanned systems, and specifically diverse perspectives, not the usual perspectives?
Good question. Again, the NSF program, we got the public perspective using SurveyMonkey. I believe it was that. I can't remember which one. But we gathered public opinion regarding what is right and what is wrong regarding a variety of different scenarios and the use of a robot, such as pill sorting for the elderly, speaking of elder care. The thing is, we did work earlier in early stage Parkinson's where this is a crucial issue. And if people make mistakes in sorting pills into the containers, it can end up doing very serious harm to them. How do you train these people if it happens to be a robot? Is it okay to give false encouragement to them during the training to keep them engaged, which often teachers do? You're doing great, Johnny, but maybe you're not doing so great, but you want to stay, keep them engaged. Is that ethically appropriate to be able to do that? And then that's what we called a high-risk scenario. And then we looked at studies if you're playing games with a robot, like Connect 4, which is what we specifically studied. Is it okay to allow you to deliberately lose a game? Should I throw a game, even though it could, because it'll keep them engaged, it'll make them happy. So from time to time, should it say, is that okay? And so we wanted to get people's opinions for both a human and a robot. What is correct to be able to do it? And we did that for both elderly and for kids as well, too. Then we looked at a high-risk situation, which we only talked about doing, we didn't do it, which was children learning how to swim. In an almost sink or swim scenario, should you say, I'll catch you, as you jump in and don't catch them? Is that ethically appropriate under those circumstances? You don't let them drown, obviously, but you might force them to actually swim. So we use this and we're trying to find ways to determine what is the right thing to put using what's called folk morality, what average people think is the right or wrong thing to do, how would you like your robot to behave under those circumstances? As compared to, as I mentioned, ethicists, who we surveyed as well too, using Kantian frameworks and consequentialist frameworks and all the different types of frameworks to say this would be the right thing to do. In practice, generally, in more mundane situations, don't do formal ethical analysis. They do what they think is right or wrong. And for example, if you're driving a car, do you obey every road law to the letter of the law? Do you never go exactly over the speed limit? Do you always come to a full stop at a stop sign? And so on. What do you want your autonomous vehicle to do? Do you want it to behave the letter of the law? And there have been instances which have shown when an autonomous vehicle came to a full stop at a stop sign, it was rear-ended because the people behind it thought it would keep going. If you allow your car to go over the speed limit, who gets a ticket? And all these kinds of issues. Or if it gets in an accident as a violation of that. Many different questions. But just because people do it, should robots do it too? That's the question we have to wrestle with. So I hope that answered the question, but about that.
Professor, you talked about autonomous vehicles quite a bit. So just a question for our audience. There may be 100,000 accidental deaths that happen every year. There was Cruise, which is a subsidiary of GM. Their car had a major accident with somebody on the hood, and that happened. Obviously, the consequences of that were the CEOs left. Now Cruise is kind of out of business in the sense they folded back in. How do you figure that out? Ultimately, the benefits of an autonomous vehicle could be saving hundreds of thousands of lives. Now, every life is very important. And obviously, this was a horrifying accident. But basically, a company that had spent billions and billions of dollars is kind of marched completely back. Now, obviously, Waymo is still out there with its robocars, et cetera. What are your thoughts on something like this?
Well, don't forget Tesla as well, too, and the number of people that have died in self-driving mode in Tesla as well. As I mentioned earlier, I tend to come down as a consequentialist, which means that if it can be shown and it is proven, best as you can prove these sorts of things, that it will have a net saving of human life, then I believe it is worth deploying. But how do you do this? That's the safety question. This is the safety practices that we were evaluating, as I mentioned before. Are these effective and adequate? I think the goal of most self-driving car programs is just that, to reduce human harm. But there are secondary and tertiary effects of these systems. It can induce road rage in others if it's going too slow, and they may get into accidents. At least there's no driver to shoot in a self-driving car, so it wouldn't make a whole lot of sense to fire at them. But there's a variety of different things that can go wrong. And one of the interesting things was that as these systems go forward, there's what are called known unknowns, which are the things we really don't know what's going to happen if this occurs. But the bigger threat are the unknown unknowns, which are the ones that keep showing up. Although these companies have had millions of miles of road experience on that, and they've learned from that, there are still instances that will come up that they couldn't have even imagined and did not even imagine. And fortunately, in general, the loss of, and this is very cavalier of me, the loss of life could be significantly less under those circumstances than would be with human drivers, which are prone to road rage and drunken driving and lack of attention and all the other things that cause accidents apart from randomness. But people expect these cars to be perfect. And that's not going to happen. That is plain and simple not going to happen. So if you are going to make the bar so high that it approaches perfection, you might as well stop considering the building of these particular systems, at least in this country. I think other countries may move forward, but I believe in trying the benchmark of saving human life and reducing casualties is significant. And that's not to say that when an accident does occur and harm occurs to an individual, that they are liable. They are recourse to lawyering and the like should be available to them. And there are standards that companies have used to evaluate how much a human life is worth regarding recalls and the like from a financial perspective. So they assess the risk of these sorts of things, which again is sounds difficult and sounds hard and inhumane to think of people in terms of dollars, but often consequentialism boils down to that as well too. But from a deontological perspective, a rights-based perspective, there is a fundamental principle, and probably the one that trumps all, is the right to life for a human being and the right to a good quality of life. And how can we protect that? How do you move forward? At what time pace? How do you do it financially? All really challenging problems. But I don't believe in stifling the advancement of technology, but regulating it, which is what you guys are all about, just the right thing to do.
That's very helpful. Finally, Professor, this has been amazingly insightful. Our audience, in many cases, is made up of members of Congress, Senate, think tanks, their staff. Any final words for them as they're slowly, in this town, we do things slow, but as they slowly advance towards regulation, legislation, your voice to them?
Good question. I have spoken to congressional aides and the like in the past, and I've interacted with the military and the Pentagon and other places over the years as well too. Listen, move forward cautiously. Slow is not necessarily bad, but try and recognize the fact that this technology will move forward. If not in this country, somewhere else. The burdens, I'm rereading the executive order from the White House. That's quite a burden on government to be able to do all those things that are listed in there in that short time frame. But organizations that you have, such as NIST, the National Institutes of Standards and Technology, I guess, that are resources that you should use. I have worked with those people in the past. They are historically wonderful people and could give guidance. The people that you've had in OSTP, Office of Science and Technology Policy at the White House, very solid. I respect them greatly, but be careful and be able to change, I guess, is the key. Recognize that some laws may work effectively at this moment, but they may need to be hardened or softened in the future as well, too. So that's my final words, I guess I can leave with them.
Thank you so much. Your final words will be sent to them. It's a real pleasure and an honor to have you. Some great insights on the future technologies and the current technologies. So thank you for being here.
It's a pleasure, Sanjay. Thank you for having me.
Thank you.
Thanks for tuning in to the Regulating AI Innovate Responsibly podcast. You'll find links in the show notes to any resources mentioned on the show. If you're enjoying our podcast, please subscribe so you'll never miss an episode and leave us a 5-star review.